How many of you have ambitions to be a farmer? Well, let's start out with farmers making a living off a farm or close to it. There's five or six. How many have at least rural urges like that? Okay. All right. So at least I have a sympathetic listener. Okay. Now, it helps to clarify what I'll mean by farmer here, because I won't intend to speak of a farmer as anyone who has a tractor and lives in the country. A farmer, I'm talking about a person with particular values, skills, and perceptions of the world that may or may not be involved directly in farming, but would be sympathetic to the values, the skills, and the perceptions, which work toward three things, probably. The care of the earth, which is directly connected with farming. Human health, which is most directly related in the production of food, and in the health of a community, and in the health of human society and community. Okay, so farmer is used in a broad sense then, and it will include people who are not necessarily raising crops. So the possibility that we all will call ourselves farmers at the end of the hour is good. I'm indebted to a farmer who opened my eyes to the fact that farming was more than just an occupation, more than just an economic enterprise. And that farmer is Wendell Berry. We have two books of his in the bookstore. How many of you read anything by Wendell Berry? Oh, good. We don't really need to do this session then. These two books are in the bookstore. This is his critique of culture, and it was the first book I read. It was given to me by my brother-in-law, saying that he thought I would like it. It's a book I've reread for 4 or 5 years now. And it is the first time anyone has taken and explained my rural urges to me. You know, the rural urges that people think are either nostalgia for the days of your grandfather and mother, or back to nature romanticism. And he was the first one to say that there is a cultural significance to farming, that the values, the perceptions, and skills that farmers used to have and still have and are in danger of being lost in our country and in the world in general, are the basis of any healthy and viable and sustainable culture. Another way to say it is agriculture is not agribusiness, it's not agri-science. That the business of tilling the earth has great impact on who we are as a people. Okay, so he was the first one that opened my eyes to that. This book is his critique of culture. This book is more a collection of examples of people who are practicing farming in that broader sense. You know, the care of the earth and the care of human health and the health of society. I can tell you just a little bit about Wendell Berry. I've had a chance to hear him. He's a farmer. He was also a professor of English or maybe American literature and a poet. He taught at the University of Kentucky for a while until he, either because of his books or because of his the income from his books, and also because his farming operation in Port Royal, Kentucky, became sustainable, or he was able to make a living off of it. And at that point, he retired immediately from the teaching profession and continued to be a writer and a poet and a full-time farmer. He does do a lot of jetting around the country and the world talking about farming and its cultural significance. And when I was living here 2 years ago, two or three of us went to hear him give the Ezra Pound Lecture at the University of Idaho in Moscow, Idaho. And we found there a tall Abe Lincoln kind of person who talked with a southern drawl and got embarrassed when he laughed and spoke with a bit of humor and sort of bashfulness that was not readily apparent in his books. And so it's helpful to remember that when you read him and to know that this is a Kentuckian or with an ironic sense of humor. I'll read one of his poems that he calls an apology or a warning to my readers. And I think I'll intersperse some of his poetry in the discussion of the values of farming and the values and perceptions of a farmer that are so important to our culture. A warning to my readers. Do not think me gentle because I speak in praise of gentleness, or elegant because I honor the grace that keeps this world. I am a man crude as any, gross of speech, intolerant, stubborn, angry, full of fits and furies. That I may have spoken well at times is not natural. A wonder is what it is. Culture is built from the ground up, literally, is one of the first propositions that you'll recognize in Barry's books. A farmer's skills and perceptions and values are first of all responsible for preserving the earth. One of the first facts of that is that a farmer and the values of a farmer require a commitment to a place, a rootedness. At the beginning of his book, Wendell Berry says that since the time of the Industrial Revolution, there have been two kinds of people. There have been two ways of approaching the earth. One is as a rooted people, as a nurturer. The other is as an exploiter, a conquistador. And he begins The Unsettling of America, I think it's chapter 2. One of the peculiarities of the white race's presence in America is how little intention has been applied to it. As a people, wherever we have been, we have never really intended to be. The continent is said to have been discovered by an Italian who was on his way to India. The earliest explorers were looking for gold, which was, after an early streak of luck in Mexico, always somewhere further on. He says that this tendency to always be moving on and looking for something better has been the dominant tendency in our world and in our experience as Americans. But he says there's always been a subordinate tendency, one that he regards as more important to our existence as a nation and the health of human culture, and that is the tendency to stay put, to say, this is far enough, no further, I will live here, I will care for this place, I will build here the place of my dying. He says it's been the subordinate tendency, and the fact that it is subordinate has led to all sorts of problems for our culture. Now, I would imagine, well, it's just a foregone conclusion, that we who come to Holden are mobile people. We have not lived in the same place for many, many years. There may be a few of us who, except for the sojourn in Holden, have stayed in one place. We at Tocoa have been, Gretchen and I have been there for a year and a half, and we have found that just in that time of getting to know the cycles of the seasons, the weather, the neighbors, that there is a real ache and a longing to stay a little longer. And there's also a tendency to withdraw at a certain point in friendships, knowing that we will not continue there. I don't know if that seems to be a universal kind of experience among downwardly mobile students that don't know where their next semester is going to be spent. It's a dangerous and destructive experience in my past, and it seems that our whole culture is based and fabricated on this mobility. One of the consequences of that mobility is that we don't have to live with the consequences of our work. or our lives. And that is one fact about being rooted in one place, is that what you do always returns upon you in one way or another. And especially those people who choose to make their living out of the ground, because all the resources are there at their disposal, and they have to dispose of what they do not need anymore, or what they have used, within sight of the house. That's changed a bit in the modern times. But the example of a farmer that Barry uses probably comes closest to approximating a person who must learn to live with their consequences. Now, I've taken the resources of the world, done what I wanted to with them, and then put them out of sight and out of mind. You know, there's trash bins everywhere. There's little pipes that you flush things down. There's somebody that comes to your door and picks things up and hauls them away. After a meal at McDonald's, there's, you know, the size of the tray that just goes and disappears in the little thank you door. Our lives, there's hardly an hour of our life that can be spent free from this taking the world's possessions and turning them into waste and garbage and just letting the consequences flow out of our life. We also have that problem because oftentimes we do not work where we live, and the work we do does not ever return to us in our homes. That once we leave the job, we never have to face or live with what our work has done. Oftentimes we don't even know what it has done in reality. We know what it ought to do and what we believe it ought to do, and what we were told in our job description it does. But oftentimes we really have no awareness of where the consequence of our work has gone. It's different in farming, Barry says, because you have to live with it and you see it. And because you live with your consequences, there are all sorts of disciplines and responsibilities that come in. And I'm sure if you think about your experience at Holden, you know that there's nothing that doesn't get thrown away or turned into garbage or disuse without your seeing it go down the road here. All right, if you have ever taken the sewer tour and have followed up some of followed the pipes to their ultimate end, you know that they nourish Jerusalem artichokes. One result of living with one's consequences is that one learns to deal with one's waste. It isn't thrown away and forgotten. And because one's waste must be dealt with, the discipline of dealing with one's waste and having it be somehow useful and not pile up and bury you and suffocate you is that it requires a radical view of the way the earth operates. And Barry describes a cyclical view, that one takes and uses the world's resources, but one returns them to the earth in a usable form. And if you think about farming with plants and animals and the kind of ecological economy that existed for centuries and millennia in farming, was that the use of animals for power was probably not because animals were so efficient, but that they were crucial in the cycle of turning of making waste usable. Animal waste could go back on and nourish the soil. Even human waste was done for that. And I'm told that in China for 40 centuries, along the roads, the farmers built attractive little outhouses. You know, and the idea was to attract as many travelers along the way to use their outhouse. And the more travelers you could attract, the more human waste you got, and therefore the more fertilizer you had. And that's a very unthinkable concept in our world. That is opposed to the way that we have lived. Barry talks about our American households being a virtual factory of waste and garbage. We take the world's goods and turn them into waste and garbage and return them to the soil or mix them with pure water in unusable forms and let someone else deal with the problem. And we again touch the problem in the way we pay taxes and in the breakdowns of those infrastructures in cities that seem to be very disconnected with our own participation in them, our own frequent flushing. The cyclical view of using the earth and returning to the earth usable things and not ending up with any waste also requires a view that the earth is shared. It's not just for human consumption, but we live here with other fellow creatures, you know, plants, animals, and their participation and their health is somehow a measure of our own. And that is something that, at least in my growing up, you saw animals in zoos, or else you saw the hardy urbanite species of squirrels and sparrows who are able to deal pretty well with our excrement and waste. It is necessary to, in our culture, to conceive of expendable resources and waste, to be able to believe that things can be just dug out and non-renewable and then passed off as waste and forgotten about, that enables us to use the machine and fossil fuels with such disattention, with such disregard. I want to read another poem by Wendell Berry entitled Horses, in which some of the themes that he talks about in his books are touched on. And this is in a book that was for a while on sale in the bookstore. I think it's a rather expensive little book. Borrow it. Horses. When I was a boy here, if I drop into a Kentuckian accent, I don't mean to do it. It's from listening to him talk. When I was a boy here, traveling the fields for pleasure, the farms were worked with teams. As late as then, a teamster was thought an accomplished man, his art an essential discipline. A boy learned it by delight as he learned how to use his body, following the example of men. The reins of a team were put into my hands when I thought the work was play. And in the corrective gaze of men now dead, I learned to flesh my will in power great enough to kill me, should I let it turn. I learned the other tongues by which men spoke to beasts, all its terms and tones. And by the time I learned, new ways had changed the time. The tractors came, the horses stood in the fields, keepsakes grew old and died, or were sold as dog meat. Our minds received the revolution of engines, our wills stretched toward the numb endurance of metal. And that old speech by which we magnified our flesh in other flesh fell dead in our mouths. The songs of the world died in our ears as we went within the uproar of the long syllable of the motors. Our intent entered the world as combustion. Like our travels, our work days burned up the world, lifting its inwards up in fire. Veiled in that power, our minds gave up the endless cycle of growth and decay and took the unreturning way, the breathless distance of iron. But that work, empowered by burning the world's body, showed us finally the world's limits and our own. We had then the life of a candle, no longer the ever-returning song among the great grass blades and the leaves. Did I never forget, or did I, after years, remember? To hear that song again, though brokenly in the distance of memory, is coming home. I came to a farm, some of it unreachable by machines, as some of the world will always be. And so I came to a team, a pair of mare sorrels with white tails and manes, beautiful, to keep my sloping fields. Going behind them, the reins tight over their backs as they stepped their long strides, revived on my tongue the cries of dead men in the living fields. Now every move answers what is still. This work of love rhymes living and dead. A dance is what this plodding is, a song, whatever it said. The values just talked about, the values of being rooted, the perception that one has to live with one's consequences, and that our wastes must be dealt with or made at least usable, and that we share the earth with other people, are of course and obviously essential to the health of the earth. And it's one thing that our modern values have it seems strayed from or have lost touch with. We are burdened with mobility, with our distance from consequences. We think in linear terms, from extraction to the production of consumer goods and waste and garbage. And we're at least oblivious, and maybe at worst hostile, to the ecological fact that we are not alone. Even in our best modern moments, when we talk of the environmental movement, if you think about the word environment, there is still a very definite separation between us and our environment. You know, that the environment is like a room or a zoo or something, and we relate to it only as a piece separate from it. And it's interesting that Wendell Berry takes on the environmental movement in the first chapter by saying that, well, you'll have to read it. He exposes the Sierra Club, who published his book, mm-hmm. as being one of the, as investing some of their members' funds in the, some of the worst strip mining companies in his state of Kentucky. And describes that as a symptom of the loss of these values in our everyday thinking. To be a farmer means to preserve human health. The first obvious connection is food. Farmers grow food. And we in America are good at growing good-looking food at a low price. Matter of fact, we as consumers insist on that. And it has done more to shape the institution of farming in this country than anything, the fact that consumers demand low price and good-looking food. That doesn't say everything that needs to be said about its value and its nutrition. And of course, it doesn't say about the non-nutritional aspects of human health. And that's where the cultural impact, the cultural significance of farming goes beyond just the raising of food. And it probably, I think probably affects those who participate in the growing of food more than those of us who are content with just low-priced food. First of all, farming, to be engaged in farming means to be engaged in meaningful work. I don't know if any of you are here because you found your work was not meaningful. I know that there have been many people passing through holding at times in pursuit of meaningful work, and people who have found that the work they have just come from did not entail a meaning that they had hoped it would. Meaningful work, in one of Wendell Berry's phrases, means to be competent in all your concerns, meaning that if you are in need of food, shelter, and clothing, to participate directly in procuring those things is meaningful work. It's necessary work. And if we do not engage in it, there is someone else in the world who does on our behalf and for our sake. That includes acquiring skills in, I guess people would call it do-it-yourself now, or being self-reliant somehow. The farmer had to be a passable mechanic, a passable carpenter, had to know just about everything about his or her homestead and how things ran. Had to be a little bit of a veterinarian, a biologist. And somehow their skills and their knowledge and their disciplines touched on every aspect of human activity that supported human life. And there was a very close connection between what one did all day and the fact that you ate and were well fed and warm at night. That connection for a lot of us is very strained and very difficult to make when we work for salaries and our dollars look like everyone else's and we have to exchange that flat currency of the world for everything that we need. And it has very little to do with our work. Meaningful work also creates in us a feeling of competence and independence and maybe interdependence and avoids the feeling that I get in the few times I've lived in cities of being a potential victim everywhere I turn. To not know anything about your car, to not know anything about your plumbing, to not know anything about the operation of the electrical lines, the sewers, all the things that you require, not even to know what day the garbage man comes, somehow leaves you to be a potential victim and to live in fear that somehow somebody is ripping you off. That's not interdependence. That's not the joyful kind of human community that can be created by people sharing their skills. It is actually a very lonely and suspicious kind of existence. And so to be competent in all one's concerns means to have enough knowledge to know when work is done well and who you can trust with it, and to know that you aren't in danger of being ripped off. And it's a rather freeing thing to have those kinds of competencies. To participate in preserving human health as a farmer, and this is one thing Wendell Berry is insistent upon, is to engage in manual labor. He has some very funny and very perceptive things to say about how we treat our bodies. He observes that for most of us, our bodies have become packing crates for our brains. Just a way to get our brains from one place to another. And he observes that there is a similarity in cities between the joggers that he sees and those people who take their pets out for walks. That somehow, you know, our work does not exercise the mind and body as it does the mind alone. And he says there are all sorts of cultural divisions that have been caused there because our work does not involve both mind and body. There is a wound and a division between our mind and bodies, that our minds seek cures for their anxieties, and our bodies seek cures for their seeming deficiencies. And rather than the model of health that we have that includes both minds and bodies, we have substituted as a standard for human existence not health, but models. And that's especially true of our physique. You know, we're never supposed to look old or bald or fat or pudgy. And he has a chapter in the book, The Unsettling of America, on the body and the earth, and insists that our anxieties about the use of our bodies and our kind of confusion about what to do with them is an agricultural problem, even for us who don't engage in farming. He says that might be the problem, is that we don't. It's also important to remember that manual labor has to be done. And if we don't do it, someone else does it. And if we refuse to do it and disregard manual labor, even in a charitable way, we first of all degrade the work, and second of all degrade the workers that do it. We can talk about, if we do have a forum on food and faith, it would be one thing I'd like to talk about is how, in the most necessary of occupations for human health, that of supplying food, the people who do the work have become the most ridiculed, the people who receive probably the least respect in our culture's exchange with one another. How many of you have been waiters or waitresses? Yeah, it's pleasant, isn't it? How about apple pickers? Fruit? Yeah, there are a couple here. You know that you do not exist in the, you know, in the center of our culture, but on the very fringes. The preparing of food, even these days, it has become something to escape from. And now I think over 50% of the products in our grocery stores are convenience foods that have already mixed things together, God knows what, and have allowed us to be free to walk the dog or play tennis. The cultural result of our putting off and ignoring manual labor has been a confusion, as I said, about what our bodies are for. Are they for sex? Are they to be beautiful? Are they for leisure? Are they just vehicles for pleasure and eating and some other sorts of dissipation? Barry says the obvious answer is we're to work with them. And we're to do work that is work of a variety that's necessary, that's obviously important to our well-being, and work that keeps us healthy and worthy of our food. I'll read another poem here. This is from Farming, a Handbook. I picked it up before I knew it was a book of poems. And it's interesting that poetry can become a handbook for this farmer. Enriching the Earth, and I want you to listen. He'll talk about some very crude subjects in this poem, and I want you to be able to hear them. To enrich the earth, I have sowed clover and grass to grow and die. I have plowed in the seeds of winter grains and various legumes, their growth to be plowed in to enrich the earth. I have stirred into the ground the offal and the decay of the growth of past seasons, and so mended the earth and made its yield increase. All this serves the dark. Against the shadow of veiled possibility, my workdays stand in a most asking light. I am slowly falling into the fund of things. And yet to serve the earth, not knowing what I serve, gives a wideness and a delight to the air, and my days do not wholly pass. In the mind's service, it is the mind's service, for when the will fails, so do the hands, and one lives at the expense of life. After death, willing or not, the body serves, entering the earth. And so what was heaviest and most mute is at last raised up into song. The values, the perceptions, and skills of a farmer also serve the human community. This is where I think Wendell Berry speaks most eloquently about it. And he speaks from the point of view of a farmer addressing what he perceives as an agricultural crisis in our country. But he soon goes beyond that and begins to talk about the cultural impact of what we are doing when we think and grow food, and what is happening when we who do not participate directly in that disregard it. It's interesting. Barry seems old-fashioned and kind of out of sync with the modern world when he says that the health of the community begins, first of all, in the household. That the unit that he regards as most important for the building of a community is a household. And he speaks mostly of the classic family, father, mother, and children. But I don't think it's necessarily limited to that. That's been his experience, and I think it's easy to make to use the word household and to think of that as we do. Those of us who have lived in small communities can relate to the fact that it is as much living like a family as is living with father, mother, and in some ways it's free of some of the cultural negativities of living with mom and dad. We do it by choice when we live out without mom and dad. He centers on the household, but he does it in a way that that describes certain functions and the household. There are certain requirements for a household in order for it to function as a culturally positive and beneficial entity. Because what we have as households in this modern world just do not work. One of the most important things about a household is that those people within it share work. He says that a phrase that we repeated last night that has stuck in my mind since I first read it. He says, "Work is the health of love," and he gives probably the clearest reason I've ever read for fidelity, for marriage at all, in that marriage and long-term fidelity are only possible when when the partners are really partners in that they work together and they have common tasks that make their lives grow together. The opposite, of course, is people who pursue different careers in different places, that there's very little there to help people grow together, and it takes a lot of energy to do that. But he says that when people engage in common work, and that when the household is a productive entity in the culture by itself, what it raises and produces and preserves its own food, it provides for some of its own needs rather than just purchasing them, that there are disciplines that create community there. And that, of course, begins to expand out into a larger community. And his conception of, you know, the broad conception of farmer will eventually include artisans, people who supply communities with necessities, and especially small towns. That there is a familial reality to those, that you know who you deal with, that somehow the peculiarities of this merchant or that tradesperson become part of your dealing with them. Now, you probably experience a lot of that at Holden Village. No longer are the people who take the garbage out, who turn your lights back on, faceless people. And you know that if you use the blow dryer, or five or six blow dryers, when the dish team is going, Merrill has to get up, or Dan has to get up and trudge out through the snow. Somehow, the understanding that a community is engaged in common, mutually beneficial work is important to its health. And that is the one thing that rural communities has offered. And it's only with great difficulty that people can see that in larger cities. And it is one of the great tragedies and probably one of the most urgent crises as far as Barry is concerned, is that we have allowed our rural cultures and the experience of that convivial community to disappear. And that it is in grave danger now. And this is one of the reasons he wrote the book. It was a statement by Earl Butz that said, what this country suffers from is an overabundance of farmers. And you could, his reaction to that was, well, if that's true, then our culture has no hope. And he sat down and wrote the book. Community health. Farming is important to community health in one more way that I can think of right now, and that is that farming may be the last experience where males can experience a nurturing occupation. Now, I, as soon as I said that, I realized there are probably many exceptions. But it is the time when men can be both husbandmen and midwives. You know, that somehow one's relationship to the earth becomes androgynous. And the culture is, we've talked about it here many times, desperately in need of recognizing the importance of nurture. And it's good that, for him to say that our relationship with the ground and the earth is something that supports and encourages and recognizes that and allows the divisions between man and woman that come when man goes off to the office and runs the machine and the woman is left home in the degrading job of trying to escape from housework. It's something that can overcome that because man and woman become partners in that. And the divisions tend to be healed. I think he would probably say that the kind of community health that's produced in small rural communities, and as he remembered them and as he has envisioned them, can eventually have an effect on a larger society. And he spends a chapter talking about Thomas Jefferson's conception of land use in the United States that talked about every one of us citizens having a small holding of land, but that would create, first of all, a very interested participation in the workings of democracy, that we would all have a stake in it somehow. and that the freedoms and liberties that we hold so dear to us in this country would be best defended and understood by those people who had a relationship and a rootedness in the earth. And I won't talk any more about that. I'll read a last poem here, page 19 of the handbook here. And it's entitled The Morning's News. To moralize the state, they drag out a man and bind his hands and darken his eyes with a black rag to be free of the light in them, and tie him to a post and kill him. And I am sickened by the complicity in my race. To kill in hot savagery like a beast is understandable. It is forgivable and curable. But to kill by design, deliberately, without wrath, that is the sullen labor that perfects hell. The serpent is gentle compared to man. That is man, the inventor of cold violence, death as waste, who has made himself lonely among the creatures and set himself aside from creation, so that he cannot labor in the light of the sun without hope or sit at peace in the shade of any tree. The morning's news drives out sleep out of the head at night. Uselessness and horror hold the eyes open to the dark. Weary, we lie awake in the agony of the old giving birth to the new, without assurance that the new will be better. I look at my son, whose eyes are like a young god's. They are so open to the world. I look at my sloping fields, now turning green with the young grass of April. What must I do to go free? I think I must put on a deathlier knowledge and prepare to die, rather than enter into the designs of man's hate. I will purge my mind of the airy claims of church and state, and observe the ancient wisdom of tribe and peasant, who understood they labored on earth only to lie down in it in peace and were content. I will serve the earth and not pretend my life could be better served. My life is only the earth risen up a little ways into the light among the leaves. Another morning comes with its strange cure. The earth is news. Though the river floods and the spring is cold, my heart goes on, faithful to a mystery in a cloud, and the summer's garden continues its descent through me toward the ground. Now, I'll only talk a couple more minutes here. First, to ask the obligatory question, what does all this have to do with following Jesus? One of the things we always bring to the text these days, and one the thing we almost always fail to notice, is that we bring, as did no other age, the most thoroughgoing and unconscious urbanization of any culture that's ever read the Bible. That has a lot of impact, because the Bible spends very little time talking about the values that I had just mentioned, because for the most part the cultures of the ancient world assumed them. They were in great peril if they did not observe those disciplines. For the most part, you have to read between the lines in the message of the prophets to those at ease in the cities of Samaria or Israel. You have to read between the lines in the people that Jesus contact. You have to look toward some sort of a urban-rural polarization there. And it just is not easy to find. And especially when we come at it with all the input and the experience of having lived through the industrial and now the post-industrial information age, we are at most distance from the ancient world in this respect, in that we are no longer people who know about the basic rural perceptions. There's not a whole lot to look at. I can point out just a couple of things that will give you some idea of their regard. First of all, maybe I just make a gross statement. The history of Israel is an agricultural history. I mean, it is always, now think about this, I think it's right. It is a journey from landlessness to landedness. And there's the loss of the land in the Babylonian exile, and then there's a return to the land. Now that's not real estate. I mean, that was a land flowing with milk and honey, and all the agricultural meanings of that. It was also, toward the end, tied very much to the city of Jerusalem. But think about that there are two modes in the existence of Israel. One is that the mode in living in anticipation of being landed, and then the other mode is to living as a landed people with the essential obligation to remember what it's like to be landless and to use one's landedness, one's turf, for the benefit of those who are not landed. Jesus fits into this way. Jesus came in some ways, using the agricultural model of Israel's history, as one who was landless. Reminding people of the obligation that riches, which in that day and age came mostly from agricultural pursuits, at least the basis for it usually came from that, that there were obligations that those who were landed had toward the poor. Jesus personified the people without land, those wandering in the exile in the wilderness, and lived in the kind of hope that the people of the exile and the people of the wandering in the wilderness lived. And it was a reminder to those people who had the world's goods that they had certain obligations toward the care of the earth, toward human health and the health of the culture, those values that I had talked about. I'm going to quit there. Maybe I'll just see if this is the poem I wanted to read to end here. No, it wasn't. Okay. Let's talk about our rural urges, maybe. Again, I'd say that the most important thing that Wendell Berry has begun in me, and since that time I've been able to find other authors who have spoken to, has been that to awaken in me that my rural urges were not just nostalgia or romanticism, that there are some eternal cultural, and we can talk about this Friday or Saturday, whenever we have the forum, religious meaning to agriculture. Well, I'd like to get to hear more about that. I have something I could say to that, but that seems to be a real one of the most crucial questions, and one of the reasons it's so urgent is because agriculture is just not in the minds of the majority of our citizens. And agriculture, that's the boring it was one time put on our bulletin board as the extremely critical boring crisis. Now, who cares about agriculture? Who would pick up this book and read it? Huh? Agriculture. Who has read a book on agriculture that wasn't required to? Who else, either thinking about friends or, you know, wondering, considering about the same things Janet said? Did anyone who live in cities see that there are... See that there are somehow glimpses of a responsibility toward the earth, that somehow values that work toward the health of the earth and the values that I talked about are being practiced in the city? And I don't think it's all hopeless. I mean, I think, your question was, does he assume an affluence?
I wasn't so much pointing to Barry as to us. Uh-huh. when we talk about this.
Well, I think, I'm thinking of some...
It's not necessarily wrong to do that. We might be talking about some new possibilities that weren't possibilities for rural life prior to the industrial and technological revolution. I mean, it's not necessarily wrong to do that, but maybe a new constellation. But.
Yeah, he's one that certainly doesn't reject, you know, the development of technology mm-hmm. and tools, and mm-hmm. He advocates selective use of horse farming. That's one example. And one thing my dad pointed out is that we know more about the structure of soil, mm-hmm. and about its the preservation of its fertility than any age has known before. And we witness all the former cradles of civilization that are just agricultural wastelands now. Mm-hmm. The Fertile Crescent, Israel, Greece, North Africa, with all just because of bad farming practice, lost their productivity. His point might be that one thing he might say about America is that we have a superabundance of natural fertility. We have been here a very short time, and a culture cannot sustain its technological or its cultural achievements without a strong agricultural base. And he'd probably say, witness the cultures that have fallen when their agriculture finally ran out. Say too that our industrial miracles have been dependent largely on non-renewable resources, mm-hmm. The exploitation of things that once they're gone we will not have. And it seems to me we are still sort of at a stage where we do that not thinking very far into the future. And that we may, I'm going to read this poem now, just as maybe a way to, we may in the future find ourselves in a position where we do not have the luxury of that prosperity that allows us to choose a sustainable agriculture. We'll be forced to it, and maybe with a lot fewer resources. 32. This is an American poem, and one that I think may be appropriate for our 4th of July. We who prayed and wept, we who prayed and wept for liberty from kings and the yoke of liberty, accept the tyranny of things we do not need. In plenitude too free, we have become adept beneath the yoke of greed. Those who will not learn in plenty to keep their place must learn it by their need when they have had their way and the fields spurn their seed. We have failed thy grace. Lord, I flinch and pray, send thy necessity. I think maybe the affluence that he sees and maybe the disregard of the resources that we have now to work with are part of the crisis that he sees.
Have you got mad for farm liberation from?
The one that ends practice. I'm not sure if I do. Is it in here? Is it in this one? The clearing or the wheel? Yeah, there's a few other mad farmer ones, but I don't know.
Country, I couldn't wait to get off the farm. It felt root bound rather than rooted. Mm-hmm. Now I can see that was my experience. I loved being on the land. I hated a lot of the physical labor because I had adapted a lot to the cultural disvalue of physical labor. But now I'm beginning to reclaim some of my past. But a lot of living in the country I found very stifling and very inhibiting to creativity and newness, parochial, all those kinds of things. But a curious phenomenon is the emergence of the Catholic worker movement, a la Dorothy Day in 1933. And she, in cohorts with Peter Marin, who was a French peasant, not a person educated in higher education institutions, but an incredibly creative thinker, his experience of being a French peasant, he traipsed over here to the United States, worked all sorts of little manual jobs and stuff, and was trying to find someone who could articulate it in a way that he couldn't. And we met Dorothy Day, who's a journalist. And there was a double vision of being a redemptive presence in the midst of urban ugliness and urban alienation, so having houses of hospitality. But the major part of the vision was to be a return to the land, was to be Catholic worker farms, where poor people, not the affluent, but poor people who were suffering most from the way that cities are and our culture's values, could return to the earth, where there'd be cottage industry, where there would be a development of both the mind and the body in the Wendell Berry sense of the word. And what's interesting is to see that the Catholic worker movement, there's been such an emphasis on the crisis of the city that the creativity of developing the vision of back to the land has not flowered. It's been, the radicalness has been to, you know, stay and criticize the culture in the city at the hospitality house, rather than creating the new vision of a new creation out there in the land. So just to see some people who started out trying to keep those things all married together, that a divorce happened someplace along the way. I mean, that seems a potential pitfall of rural communities.
Yeah, there, I've just, you hear rumors of the number of rural projects that have failed because of the rigor of the labor involved in you know, providing for your own food, the lack of stimulation that often is claimed in rural areas. I have not lived on a farm long in my life. I mean, 6 years total. And I was, as soon as I got home from school, I backed a 57 Chevy convertible up to the gas pump, filled it up, and went to town. So I have a lot of cultural things I'm struggling with. And it was one of the things I fear about my future as a farmer, is to find myself becoming parochial, a rube, a hayseed, a clodhopper, that sort of thing. Lose my urbanity.
Similar experience to Maryland.
Yeah, that's a real important one. Looking at it from the point of view of the ALC, the churches, people in rural ministry have noticed that the spirit that used to exist in rural towns is dead. Mm-hmm. And that is probably the most grim cultural fact, is that not only are the resources less there, but people do not even believe in the resources that they have. And that the schools close and consolidate, they've lost the gathering of the school. The last thing that's left is the church. And the model of the church that we have makes it almost impossible financially to carry on a church with members numbering in the 30s or 40s.
The question I continue to have then is, how is my brother, who now owns that farm, instilling his children some of the things that I'm seeing that we and my brothers and my sister and I have, and it's not happening?
Yeah. That's what makes it a grave crisis. Is that it's a cultural problem, you know, to say that there are values and there is an importance to the rest of the nation in having a viable urban culture, and this is why it's important. Nobody is saying that. Very few. And so people have, there is no reason to stay, and you apologize for coming from a small town or from the Midwest. I said it, I'm sorry.
You promise.
Vern had his hand up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say probably it is selective, and I think that Barry would make no apologies about that. He has said that the tendency toward these values has been a subordinate one, even in rural areas.
Yeah.
And he would say that he'd probably say unabashedly he is being selective, that somehow his hope is that those positive values would be nurtured, and that those that were negative and that abused the soil and were parochial could be forgotten.
But a lot of what you're advocating is in the discipline and style you're bringing to the farming, not simply in going back to the land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You learn something from being in exile. If you've been on the land and you leave it and go out and have different experience. When you come back, you're going to do it in a different way.
But there's all sorts of losses that seem to occur there, is that you can't have first-generation farmers all the time. Huh?
Well, the kibbutz is make people leave the kibbutz in order before they can take their permanent vows. There is, uh-huh. You can have a system where you send people into exile before you have them to decide whether
okay. That, yeah. Barry himself says that his book is a scathing critique of our culture and our practice of agriculture, but he says in one place that the answer is as yet unthinkable. His point is to try to elucidate what he sees as the problems and allow, and he's not one to form a grand nationwide or global solutions. I even heard him say there is no hunger problem. There are only hunger problems in this location and in that location. And he doesn't like the word model. He uses the word example. And that this book here, rather than saying this is my plan for agricultural, century two or millennium 2000, he says here's an example. Here's an example. Here's an example. And that's kind of his constructive argument is that. There are places out there that you can find the worst values shunted and some of the better values supported. Practice. I don't know. The critics would say it's because they have a very iron-fisted, autocratic, over-disciplined culture. Barry's kind of sympathetic to him. He says that's because they practice good agriculture and they've been able to be countercultural. Now, there may be the truth is somewhere in between there. I don't know many Amish people, and if anyone does, they could say more. I suspect that both are true. I've seen Amish that would give me both impressions.